If you were to summarize a couple of the nuggets of things for other entrepreneurs to do a version of what you've done, you know, what are some of the top things that you point to?
Taking time to self-reflect about what you're great at and what you need to improve as a leader is really valuable. I tell our team all the time, 2 years from now, if I'm the same CEO as I am today, I will not be the right CEO for this business 2 years from now.
Everyone, welcome back to Taking Care of Business. I'm Mike Katz, EVP of the T-Mobile Business Group, and today I'll be chatting with Henry Schuck, founder and CEO of ZoomInfo. In 2007, Henry co-founded Discover.org, which built the industry's highest quality data sets through a mix of automated tech and human-in-the-loop AI. In 2019, Discover.org acquired ZoomInfo, a go-to-market solution for over 20,000 companies worldwide, which, by the way, facilitated the largest IPO of 2020. Well, Henry, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I'm excited to be here with you.
Well, first, let me jump right into it. Is it true that you founded Discover.org while you were only 23 years old and actually still in law school?
That is true. I was 23 years old when we founded the business. I was in law school. I founded it in my law school dorm, put $25,000 on my credit card and my co-founder's credit card, and we started building the company.
So, I got to dig into that one a little bit more. How did you, one, possibly find the time to do that? And what was the inspiration for it? Because this seems like what you do now seems like a far departure potentially from pursuing a law career.
Yeah, totally. First of all, much more enjoyable than law school, starting the business. Even though it added a whole bunch of chaos to my life, it was I was enjoying it much more, so it didn't hurt that much. But I had worked at a similar company when I was an undergrad. So I had a college job. I was working 40 hours a week, and I worked at this company that was doing something similar. But it really wasn't building a business. It was really kind of a lifestyle business. There were a couple of college kids doing things. But there was a huge demand for the product and for the service. And essentially, it was providing sellers and marketers with the data that they needed to identify their next best customer. And there was all this demand. The owner was basically on the phone all day long just closing deals. And then there wasn't much of a business apparatus behind it. So I felt, you know, pretty convicted that we could build something real there, that we could invest behind the business, and then provide customers with a much fuller suite of products and services that they would need. The fun story there is we actually went back and bought that company about 6 years after we founded Discover.org and then integrated it in. So the company I worked at in college ended up being one of the companies we acquired along the way, which was an interesting, fun day.
Well, and it saved the world from another lawyer, which I feel like we all won from that. I can say that because I'm married to a lawyer, so I'm allowed to say that. When you first started the business, what was your vision of it? Where were you expecting it to go? And you know, as the last decade has rolled out and you've gone from a startup company to a big company, like how has the actual execution of the company changed from your original vision?
Yeah, super interesting. When we founded the business, it's 2007, and there weren't very many software or technology or data tools for salespeople or for marketers. And what we started building was essentially a platform that sellers could use to identify their customers, to identify who makes a buying decision. And what we realized was there were a whole bunch of other pieces of software and technology that sellers needed to go to market in a digital world that they were asking for, that they were begging for, that they were consuming from, you know, a number of different vendors in the marketplace. But what we realized was when you plug data underneath any of those specific applications, the applications really came to life. You got better analytics, you got better processes, you were in one single pane of glass. And so what started off as, hey, let's build really great data that salespeople can use, really morphed into let's build a go-to-market platform that's modern, that uses data at its foundation to drive up and through an application layer that sellers can leverage every single day to do everything from engaging with their clients to identifying who's in market for their services to doing website chat or voice analytics on their calls to understand which calls had positive sentiment or negative sentiment. And so it's essentially now become a modern go-to-market platform for sellers. But that vision, you know, at 23 years old, I was building a data company, and it really evolved over time. And, you know, technology has moved incredibly fast. Our space has moved incredibly fast. And so, you know, if you're an entrepreneur sitting, sitting down at home in your second or third year of business, and you're like, well, I can't think 10 years ahead, I totally get it, either could I. A lot of this came in an evolutionary way. You do one thing, you execute it really well, and you put your eyes ahead for the next thing. And I think that's one thing we've done really well at the company, is that we've executed really well on one particular part of our vision, and then we opened the opus to other parts of the vision and started executing on those as well.
I find it so fascinating because you and I have talked about this in the past that there's so much data available to companies now, both their first party data and third party data that they can procure, that it essentially makes it almost impossible for a human to process and make the most optimized decisions. And so the idea of being able to take these really complex data sets and being able to curate decisions for people, I just find extraordinarily fascinating. When you think about where you guys are today and the evolution of data, the evolution of technologies that process data like machine learning and AI, like where do you think we're headed? You know, what is the salesperson of, you know, 2030 look like with these powerful data sets behind them?
Yeah, so I think first of all, we're super early in that process. We're super early in leveraging both first and third party data to make better decisions in the sales motion. We're at the, you know, somewhere in the before the first inning ended. So really early in the process. And I think what you see in the future is, again, today we have all of these systems that we're using to go to market. And we are using systems, right? A seller today sits at a computer for most of the day and is making calls, is doing emails, is updating forecasts, is in Salesforce, is in Zoom Info. And every action that they're taking, there's a system behind it. And so it can capture all of this really interesting data. And it's two-way, right? Prospect responds, that's a piece of data. Prospect responds with the words, let's take the next step. That's a key message that can be captured, a key piece of data that can be captured. And so today I think we're in a world where now we're capturing a lot of data from a lot of systems and we're storing it and we're doing little things here and there with it. But where we're going is really being able to not just capture that data, but start making sense of it in a holistic way. And so I think that the sales rep of the future is gonna come in, they're gonna sit down, and they're gonna be presented with a whole bunch of recommendations for their next steps that they're supposed to take in their business. And it'll take advantage of every call you've had, it'll take advantage of every customer meeting you've had, every customer conversation that's happened, and then it'll take advantage of third-party data. Which of your prospects are growing, which ones are shrinking, which ones just got funding, which ones just hired a new chief information officer or chief executive, which one added a specific technology or removed a specific technology from their stack. And there's just too many key data points today for one salesperson to triangulate. But in the future, all of that data will come into one place, we'll do analysis on it, and then we'll present the salesperson with their next best steps. And so what's interesting about that is, today, that's a big value that a sales rep brings to the table, that ability to prioritize and understand what's going on in their accounts. In the future, what's super interesting is that the relationships become significantly more important. Because now you know what to do, your ability to build trust with your client, your ability to build strong relationships with them where you're consultative and helping to drive their businesses forward, that becomes, again, the sales rep superpower. Because who you should be contacting, what you should be contacting them about, that'll be delivered to you through the systems.
Yeah, and I think it's so exciting because, you know, to the point that you just made, like in today's world, so much of the sales process is it's about how many people can I contact? And, you know, and unfortunately for salespeople, oftentimes it's how many people can I contact and how many no's can I get before I get a yes? And I think what you just described that's so exciting to me personally is how could salespeople refocus or reinvest their time into the people that are likely to say yes in building relationships and expanding opportunities versus so much energy into all the no's. I think that to me, that's one of the most exciting prospects of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's bi-directional, right? Because if you're contacting the people who are in market for your services, who have the biggest need, who are most interested, who all of the signals tell you this is the person you should be engaging with, well, they want to engage with you because they have a business problem they need to solve. And you are likely a person with a product or a service that can solve that problem for them. I think that's one of the things I think sellers, especially early in their careers, they miss. They think they're out there just like schlepping goods, basically. But the reality of the situation is you're providing a service or a product that helps another business person solve something in their business that they need solved. It, you know, clears a bottleneck that allows them to grow and be more successful and hire more employees and open more locations. And I think once you have that shift in perspective where you realize your product or services is unlocking potential within businesses, just this whole selling motion becomes much more enjoyable.
So one question for you with all of this data, that's being collected, you know, again, you know, through some of the transactional work that you talked about, even just, you know, recording of notes from conversations, you know, third-party data that's being purchased. You know, as you're talking to business leaders, what are some of that we talked about all the benefits, all the data, but what are some of the things that business leaders should be thinking about in terms of protecting data or unintended consequences of not managing all this data appropriately?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, the first one is you have to be great stewards of the customer data that you're collecting. The vendors that you interact with that collect that data or control it for you have to be held in the highest regards. They have to have the right security infrastructure and framework to be able to hold and be stewards of that information. You know, I'll give you the example that came to mind here for me is we just acquired a company called Chorus.ai, and Chorus has technology that records customer conversations, transcribes them, and then identifies key moments in those conversations that help managers ramp their employees. It helps them improve their sales reps so they convert more. Every time there's a key moment in a conversation, it zeroes in on that. So instead of a manager doing a ride-along for a two-hour call, they can jump into Chorus and then jump to key moments in conversations to drive impactful coaching and onboarding. And I think when you think about that, you're recording every customer conversation that a company is having, and your duty to store that properly, to protect that information, to give end users the ability to opt out of having that information collected and deleted if they wanted to have that information deleted, that is a huge responsibility that you have in your data, your ability to source where the data came from and how it was sourced. That all of that and being a great steward of that data is incredibly important because companies want to be able to leverage these technologies. They want to be able to leverage big data, but they want to partner with people that they can trust in order to do that. And so trust and privacy and security, those are, you know, pillars of any modern business.
When you look forward to, like you mentioned AI there a couple of times, I'm interested to get your perspective on technologies like AI and machine learning and where you see them going. Because I think you even mentioned overall, we're kind of at the infancy of all the entire way that this big data gets managed. But when you think about AI and machine learning, when you think about technologies like 5G and edge computing coming in and like really reducing latency, where do you see that market going? What are some of the use cases that you think will emerge from AI?
Yeah, so when I think about AI today, especially in the go-to-market motion, I think about how we have this incredible opportunity, like we just talked about, to identify your next best customers, to route customers to the right representatives at the right time. When I think about 5G today, you know, most business-to-business software gets built with a desktop-first mentality. It gets built for someone who's sitting behind a desk with a computer monitor. And I think as 5G and edge computing becomes sort of commonplace for businesses, that they're going to realize that we live in a mobile-first world. And all of that software that we've built with a desktop-first mentality is going to need to be digitally transformed into a mobile-first workforce, because more and more of the content we're creating, more and more of the interactions we're having with our customers is happening on a mobile device. And as the 5G technology is in our hands every day and gives us tremendous capabilities, I think we're gonna see people building much more in a mobile first way. Look, I think for us, that means we have to rethink the way we build software. We have to rethink the way our end users use our software. And I think that's going to be a very transformative moment in software, especially in the B2B software.
As you think about your roadmap going forward in these capabilities that you're building, we've talked a lot about it in the context of salespeople and the interactions that salespeople are having with their customers. Are you thinking about, you know, other uses for it? Are there other applications that you see for the platform that you've built and the data sets that you guys have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things we're providing data to our customers, and our customers expect that data to be incredibly high quality. And so we've built machine learning and AI into the ways we collect data and the way that we identify when data is accurate or inaccurate. And we're combining, you know, multiple data sets. We have over a million different unique sources that come into ZoomInfo. And then we're making decisions about what's accurate and what's not accurate. We're making those decisions based on historical values of different sources of information that come in. We're making those decisions based on triangulation of different data sources. And machine learning is really at the heart of every decision we make about what to publish in our platform or what not to publish in our platform. And as those technologies advance, and we've seen it within our business really just in the last year, where we've embedded new machine learning technology, new AI technology, and we've increased accuracy rates of the data that we provide our customers in real material ways across the business.
Any other industries you think are ripe for disruption?
I mean, I think you're already seeing it, or you're seeing the opportunity in healthcare. There was actually, this weekend, there was a New York Times article about Watson and IBM's Watson and sort of what's happened with that from an AI and machine learning capability. But any sort of industry where there's a tremendous amount of data that can be crunched to provide predictive outcomes, that's where I think you're going to see AI and machine learning really take hold. And I think, you know, healthcare, financial services, even in retail, especially with e-commerce, I think when you can crunch a whole bunch of data to make the right recommendations, you'll see, you know, AI and machine learning really take off.
Just out of curiosity, this past year, as we were all in the pandemic and everybody's working remotely, and a lot of our interactions were through, you know, forums like this, you know, digital, people were in front of their computers a lot more often. Did you see an expansion of data sets, you know, this year relative to previous years?
Yeah, absolutely. There was, you know, when you went from many sales teams being in the field and many interactions being face to face to a world where every interaction was digital, we saw the number of emails our customers were sending skyrocket. We saw the number of Zoom meetings skyrocket, both internally and externally. We saw the number of phone calls being made to customers and prospects skyrocket. And so you really, in a world where you're forced to act digitally, you know, we saw sellers taking advantage of those digital tools. We saw interaction on chat significantly increase across the company as well. So a lot of sort of uptake of these digital technologies that were in place, but were not being leveraged as fully as they are now.
Makes sense, and it makes you wonder how much. I mean, I think we're all asking ourselves that in the new normal, whatever you want to call it. How much of those things will persist versus, you know, conversations where you're physically there, where you may get the benefit of building a stronger relationship potentially if you're physically there and can actually shake hands, but you lose potentially the benefit of robust data collection and record keeping. That's a lot easier to do in a digital or virtual environment.
I get the feeling, Mike, that most of the interactions we have with our customers and our prospects in the future will be a mix of both digital and in person. So even if I'm sitting in the office, if I'm sitting in the office in Boston and I'm having a meeting with a customer, then my sense is somebody's gonna be teleconferenced into that meeting as well. And once you bring in sort of the digital teleconference motion into the fold from a business meeting perspective, you get all those benefits of the digital signals alongside it. Like, it's hard to imagine a meeting where there isn't some digital component to it in addition to the in-person components.
Yeah, it's amazing how that's changed, hasn't it?
Totally.
We've gone from a world where it was hard to imagine that actually happening to now imagining it not happening. It's crazy how fast that's evolved.
Absolutely.
Hey, if you don't mind, I wanted to jump into talking a little bit about you as a business leader, because you've had an amazing journey. What you've done and what you've built with this company has just been incredible. And it's the dream for many, many entrepreneurs. And I was hoping you could just talk a little bit about, you've been involved in lots of mergers and acquisitions. You've been involved in a company that was a startup to now one that's publicly traded. If you were to summarize a couple of the nuggets of things for other entrepreneurs to do a version of what you've done, what are some of the top things that you point to?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, and also thank you for that, Mike. It's been a pretty great journey, and I'm thankful for it every day. I think I realize so much more today than I ever have that none of it is possible without the great employees that we've hired along the way, today. I think one of the problems is today the CEO or the founder is put on like some sort of special pedestal, like I'm some kind of special genius. I think the biggest thing I've done well is I've hired well. And I've been vigilant about talent. And I've made sure that I hired the right people in the key roles, and I gave them the support that they needed to be successful. And their success really is just my success. And so really believing that about your key employees, really about all of your employees, I think is a major differentiator. Every CEO will give you that same advice, hire well. But like, what does it actually really mean? It means that sometimes hiring takes a long time. It means that you have to be really patient with hiring. And so if you know you have a key role, we oftentimes go out to market and then we find sort of like five potential people, and we go, okay, it's been 6 months looking for this person. Which one is it going to be? And you just make the choice. And I think the biggest lesson I've learned along the way is be patient about that process, feel really great about the person you're bringing into your company, and then give them a ton of support to be successful in the different roles that you fill. But I've seen time and again, at the startup phase and the public company phase, there's something in the company that's not running very well. You go out, you hire a great, talented person, and all of a sudden, boom, that thing turns around. I remember sitting at a conference one time watching the CEO of a public company, and they asked him, what's unique about your business that's made you so successful? And he said, it was actually a fitness company. He said, look, we make great fitness devices, but really it's all about our people and it's all about our culture. And I remember being so frustrated hearing that, because I was like, no, just like tell me the thing so I can go make sure that I'm mimicking that thing. And everybody says, it's people. And I just thought it was such a like a corporate answer to the question. And then I went home, and because I really respected the CEO, I ran it through my head over and over and over again. And I realized I've said dozens and dozens and dozens of times at that point, if I could just clone this person 100 times, if I could clone that person 20 times or 30 times, this business would be far bigger than it is today. And I believed in that, but I really didn't think that like an answer that says your employees are the most important part of your business was also true. And I realized I had just been saying all along, it's all about the employees. And so if you hire really well, and you build the right culture and you let people run as fast as they possibly can, I think that's it's a winning strategy. I think one of the things that I've always done with the different people on my teams is I've had a very big vision for them. And oftentimes that vision was bigger than what they saw for themselves. And so my job became getting them to see that same vision that I saw for them and giving them the confidence that they could execute on that same vision. And in a startup environment and in a small company environment, that's incredibly important because you're often hiring people with not a lot of experience. You're hiring people who are talented and hardworking, but they haven't seen the story happen. And so it is incumbent on you to create that story and create a vision for them to really really live up to. And I've been most proud of that at ZoomInfo, is really helping our young leaders see a vision for themselves that they didn't see on their own, and then really helping them reach their potential. I think that's incredibly rewarding. And then maybe one anecdote is really until we IPO'd, which was last year in the middle of the pandemic, I think I, like many other startup founders and entrepreneurs, had what's Wikipedia-able as imposter syndrome, which is basically like you don't think you had anything to do with it, that your skills are not particularly needed in the success of the business, but you were kind of in the right place at the right time, you caught some lucky breaks along the way, and geez, if someone actually came into the business and saw what was really happening, they'd be so disappointed in you and realize that you're just kind of like a fraud. You're not really like a great leader, or you're not particularly inspirational or running a very good company. I think that's really hard to get over. It also gives you a great chip on your shoulder. I think really taking time to self-reflect about what you're great at and what you need to improve as a leader is really valuable. I tell our team all the time, like I am not the right CEO for this business right now, 2 years from now. Right now I am. 2 years from now, if I'm the same CEO as I am today, I will not be the right CEO for this business 2 years from now. Things are moving too fast, the business is growing too fast, there will be more complexities and new things that I have to learn along the way over those next 2 years. And unless I'm committed to improving every day and learning every day, then I can't be the best CEO that this company can have 2 years from now. And so the last thing I would say is being committed to learning and getting better and improving and identifying the places that the business needs you to improve and up level at, that's a key part of being a great leader. And at some phases in my career, it was like very tactical. I had to know how to run the best marketing program. I had to know how to give the best sales pitch. And at some points in my career, like today, a lot of it is about how do I communicate the vision for what we're building to the public markets, to our shareholders, to our employees. But that's all those different stages required me learning some new skill. And so being committed to learning is, it's the greatest advantage.
I love that. I particularly love your comments about the focus on people, bringing the right people in, taking big bets on people, really, really leaning into building a unique, distinct culture. I just really resonates with me a ton. When you kind of think back on this last 13, 14 years as you've been building this company, anything that sticks out to you that, if you went back, you're like, man, I wish I had done this differently, or I wish I'd made this decision earlier. Anything big like that that sticks out to you?
I wish I was vocally committed to improving every day and sending a message like that through our teams. And I think once we sort of realize that one of the core value drivers at ZoomInfo is the ability to improve 1% a day every single day, people really buying into that idea of self-improving and being the best versions of themselves, I think the business took a, inflected. And I think along the way, a lot of times we were almost embarrassed about that because it required lots of changes. So we would come in and we'd go like, that thing we were doing for the last 6 months? We don't think that's a good idea anymore. We're gonna do it this way now. And people would be like, oh my God, like why would you do this to us? And like once you realize it's because we're committed to improving every day. it gets people bought into that vision in a much different way. Today, we do this thing called, we do a Shark Tank internally at ZoomInfo, where we basically go out to all of our employees and we say, hey, pitch us your best idea for what ZoomInfo should be doing from a product perspective and from a process perspective. And so from a product perspective, then they get in front, the finalists get in front of the entire company, they pitch the idea, and then the winner, we commit resources behind seeing that product idea and bringing it to market. On the process side, I actually think it's even more exciting because our frontline employees have so much visibility into things that we're doing in an old way that should have been fixed along the way. And they're able to come to us and go, look, this process requires 17 steps. I bet we can do it in 3, and this is how we do it. 1, 2, 3. And we go, oh, that's the great. We should do that tomorrow. And so even if you don't win that competition, the second, third, fourth, and fifth place finalist, we're implementing those suggestions into the business. And so really just embedding this idea that we can improve every day is just a tremendous force multiplier for us.
When you think about, again, the evolution of your business, and I actually want to come back to the point that you're just making about how, you know, the continuous relentless on pushing. I want to come back to that in a second. But when you think about the last, you know, 12, 13, 14 years, at what point did you feel like you guys made a pivot from a startup into a mature company? Yeah, did it happen slowly over time, or was there like a catalyst moment for that? Like when did that pivot, do you think, occur for you?
Yeah, so we were Discover.org until February of 2019 when we acquired ZoomInfo. And when we acquired ZoomInfo, the day that happened, it did feel like we became more than just a startup company. We had 1,000 employees. We went from 500 employees to 1,000 employees overnight, which, by the way, brings all sorts of infrastructure challenges and people challenges. And when you're instrumented to be a 500 employee company, it's a lot different than instrumenting to be a 1,000 employee company. We had to catch up real quick. But that day, I think it felt like we had a product and a team that could take us to the next level. And it didn't, you know, it also felt like much of the lift for the next stage of the company was not going to be particularly on my shoulders, but that it would be on the leaders that we acquired from ZoomInfo, really merging with the leaders at Discover.org to take us to the next stage. And, you know, and to the, hey, always we're a best ideas wins company. You know, the company I founded in 2007 was called Discover.org. We acquired this business, ZoomInfo, in February of 2019. And for lots of reasons, including nobody called Discover.org the right name. They would call it Discover.org or Discovery.org or Discover or Discovery. We switched the name to ZoomInfo. And I remember when we did that, people were like, whoa, are you going to be okay? Like, Henry, are you personally going to be okay? And it was such an interesting comment because it was like, look, I'm focused on building a great business, and this is the best business decision for the company. And so that, I think, stems throughout the business today. Everyone's looking to make the best decision.
One of the things I so much appreciate about you is what you were talking about a second ago, which is just this relentless pushing. You know, and it's something that I think is so important for any company that's in a big growth stage. It's the mentality of, hey, what was good enough yesterday isn't going to be good enough for us tomorrow. And, yep. You know, really challenging the status quo. I know you hate when people say, hey, that's the way it's always been done. And obviously, that's something that you really embody as a leader. But when you think about now a company that's, you know, 1,000 plus people, how have you... You know, really, and you talked about the Shark Tank and what you're doing to engage your frontline, but what are some of the other things that you're doing to really infuse that into the culture of ZoomInfo?
Yeah, so a number of things, but our regular operating cadence is that we bring together every month all of the key members of every department at the company for a monthly operating review that I sit in on, our president sits in on, our chief financial officer sits in on. And essentially that meeting is designed to, number one, show what things went well. And really, the things that went well are important because you want to make sure you don't miss those things, but things that go well tend to continue to go well. If you nailed the execution on something, you know, you'll probably continue to nail the execution on something. And so a lot of those most of the monthly operating review is to really dive into the things that didn't go well, identify what didn't go well, and then articulate a plan to solve those things for the future. And so every month, every department comes in, we look at how we operated for the month previously, and then we're digging into areas of improvement across the company. And it's super valuable because everybody comes in there with an improvement mindset. And they know, I think, you know, maybe the most important thing there, Mike, is they have to trust that we all have the same motivation. Like, my goal is not to like tear down bad performance in a given month. It's to work with you to solve it, to identify it, make sure we both see it, right? Like, I can't see it and you not see it and us get to a good outcome. We have to both be on the same page about what it is that we're solving. And then if you really believe that my motivation is to build the best possible company that we can build, then we're totally aligned on going and solving that together. But if you think like my motivation is to be the smartest guy in the room or prove that I know marketing better than you or that I understand something or to just show off my intelligence in a meeting, we're never gonna get anywhere. And so we have to have a foundation of trust where you truly believe that my goal is to improve the company. And if we're aligned on that, then it's super easy to go like, you know, point at things and poke at things and say, like, how do we make that a little bit better? How do we make that a little bit better?
I think it's such an important thing for a leader. Again, you know, especially one that's in a position like you with a hyper growth company to have that mentality. So it's so cool to hear about how, one, you're living it and then how you're pushing it through your org. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've now reached everyone's favorite time in taking care of business, which is the rapid fire section. So if you're game for it, I'd love to hit you with some rapid fire questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
The most important questions, some will argue, of this entire segment. So first one, talk or text?
Talk.
This is going to be a controversial one. iOS or Android?
They're both customers, so both.
Both. He's carrying two phones with it.
I have plenty of systems that run on iOS and plenty of systems that run on Android.
There's only one right answer to this. The other one will be deeply offensive to me, but music or podcast?
Podcast.
Oh, of course. Okay, yeah.
Of course.
It's a leading the witness. mobile or console games?
You know, I'm not a gamer. I don't play games. So I couldn't tell you. My daughter plays them on iPad. So I'll go with my daughter's answer. So mobile.
Okay. Slides or flip-flops?
So I saw this question. What are slides?
It's so funny. When we were writing these, somebody asked me the same question. Like, you don't know what slides are? I feel like that's the only footwear my kids wear. I don't know if this is the right technical description of them, but I describe them as they're flip-flops without like the thing that goes between your toes.
Got it. Flip-flops.
Yeah. Okay. running or hiking?
Running.
Early bird or night owl?
Definitely an early bird.
Okay. Well, Henry, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being here. It's so incredible to hear about the story and the journey that you've taken ZoomInfo on. And I know for a lot of people that are listening that really you know, have a goal of doing something similar to what you've done, hearing how you've done it is really inspiring. And I think I love how you kind of boil it down to a couple of really key concepts. It's about people. It's about pushing the status quo. It's about building a differentiated, powerful culture. And there are things that sound really, really easy, but you know, I think you know better than anyone else because you've been doing it in a super successful way for the last decade plus. That it's hard and it takes a lot of work. But it was so incredible to hear from you, to hear your story, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you for having me here on the show, Mike. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun.
Every episode of Taking Care of Business, as part of T-Mobile's Project 10 Million, we donate to a school of our guest choice. This time, we're closing the homework gap with a donation to Evergreen School District in Vancouver, Washington. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next time on Taking Care of Business.